And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So here we are. We are doing today Death by Astonishment, DMT, Terrence McKenna, Rick Strassman Radio. So we welcome the ancestral Terrence McKenna, whose messages are really all hopping up and down for us now, I will delineate, and also the living Dr. Rick Strassman, author of DMT, The Spirit Molecule, and many other books that have sold 150,000 copies, that we may explore the biology of near death and death, and the evolutionary opportunities available to humanity now for reanimating the necessity of conscious kinship. Rick Strassman's website is rickstrassman.com. So let me welcome you in, Dr. Rick Strassman, joining us from Albuquerque. Welcome.
Well, thanks, Caroline. I'm glad I could be on the show today.
Yeah, no, we're going to do an experiment of weaving to and fro of two storytellers. You are a clinical associate of professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. Thank you. So you are a mystic in a lab coat. We hosted you, I think, last December on DMT. We want to explore the pineal gland as a locus for spiritual experience, the spirit molecule. Impressive that so many people are eager to learn about this. Certainly the Old Testament concept of prophecy, there we go. Why you're a heretic in the Zen world. We want to remember that the word heretic was an honorific, you know, in early religion, because it means free thinker. So you are that, right?
Oh, I didn't really know that. I always thought heretic was bad.
No. We're going to liberate all of us. Liberating Rick Strassman. You have things to liberate us and Terrence and DMT and everything. So many things that we want to explore. But with your kind playfulness, I want to just introduce Terrence to our listeners, and we'll play a 10-minute clip of Terrence on his take on DMT, and then bring us back in. Is that good with you?
Sounds good.
Okay, wonderful. So I have since talking to Rick Strassman last December, I have had an intimate DMT experience myself, and I was like, let me find allies. What an amazing journey. What an amazing experience. Astonishing really does come to mind. Astounding, all of those things. And so, of course, I picked up my buddy Terrence McKenna's file and his chart, and I go, oh, look, Terrence McKenna, you know, his son, S-U-N, was at 23 Scorpio. The image for that is a man delivering a sermon on a mount. And we go, oh, that's very Terrence. And I like also that our charts, these mysteries of life and death, our charts can get animated even when we're dead. So Mars will be retrograding now and then stationing right on top of Terrence McKenna's son, June 18th through mid-July, Sermon on a Mount. We want to listen to messages. We want to be messengers. I love that Neptune, representing how a culture tells itself its own story through dreams and images that circulate through mass mind. Neptune is trining Terrence's Jupiter, whose image was the Renaissance Council. And so let's convene that, remembering that we are the molecules whereby the big story speaks with itself through the agency of synchronicity. And emerging from my DMT, very worthy, intriguing experiment, I quipped to myself, as we do when we emerge from the underworld, going, wow, if actual death is less showbiz, death should get its money back. And now let's go to a little, I turned to Terrence and his wonderful talk on death by astonishment. So here we go. Here we go. Yes, we're going. No. Whoops. We have kerfuffles. But I should mention that Mercury is retrograde. So there are kerfuffles. That was the beginning of the beautiful Makana, but we're going a different way. We have the Terrence McKenna clip lined up from zero. Yes, we do. Oh, yes, we do. Okay, that's great. Okay, the backstage spirits are willing. And there we go.
There he is.
Okay.
If it's possible to get more loaded than that, I don't want to know about it. And I say so when I'm there. I say, my God, if you can get more loaded than this, keep it away from me. So that's it. It's the strongest. It's also the shortest acting. DMT, when smoked, in most people, is return you to normal in under 10 minutes. Under 10 minutes. Now, this is interesting because people who think there's nothing to this, who should actually invest the 10 minutes to find out what's, you know, a 10-minute DMT trip is worth 20 years of academic pharmacology, art history, psychology, and all this other malarkey. Because then you just say, okay, I got it. Another very interesting thing about DMT is it occurs naturally in the human brain. Well, now what's going on here? He's saying the strongest drug, the fastest drug, is the most natural drug. It means that, you know, you don't have to sail off into 3-hydroxy-4-pyridyl-N-methyl-marubishtik or something like that to get into the exotic realms. No, a human metabolite, which takes only 10 minutes to undergo its entire exfoliation and quenching, is the strongest of all. Well, then what is it? What does strong mean? What is a strong psychedelic? You know, it's highly personal. Every psychedelic trip is. But what happens on DMT for a large number of people, I mean, we don't have any statistics, but it is a completely confounding experience. I mean, you may have had the expectation, you might think if you had never had a psychedelic experience, that it sort of begins like the Bach B minor fugue and goes from there as you rise into the realms of light and union with the deity or something like that. That's not what happens on DMT. What happens on DMT, I referred to this morning, a troop of elves smashes down your front door and rotates and balances the wheels on the after-death vehicle, present you with the bill, and then depart. And it's completely paradigm-shattering. I mean, you know, union with the white light you could handle. An invasion of your apartment by jewel self-dribbling basketballs from hyperspace that are speaking in demotic Greek is not something that you anticipated and could handle. Sometimes people say, is DMT dangerous? It sounds so crazy. Is it dangerous? The answer is only if you fear death by astonishment. Remember how you laugh when this possibility was raised, and a moment will come that will wipe the smile right off your face. And this death by astonishment thing, Well, one thing about it, I mean, let me say a little bit more about it. One thing that endears DMT to me is I like to say it doesn't affect your mind. It doesn't seem to affect your mind. In other words, you don't change under the influence of DMT. You don't become a kinder, gentler person. You don't sink into, you know, a line of drool from one corner of your mouth as you sit there twitching. You don't change. What happens is the world is completely replaced. Instantly, 100%, it's all gone. And what is put in its place, not one iota of what is put in its place was taken from this world. So it's a 100% reality channel switch. They don't even retain three-dimensional space and linear time. It's not like you go to an exotic place, Morocco or New Guinea. It's like you reality is swapped out for something else. And when you try to say what it is, you realize that language has evolved in this world, and it can serve no other. It takes years of practice. So what you're looking at is literally the unspeakable. The indescribable falls into your lap. And when you try, you're loaded, right? You're there, and you're trying to explain to yourself what's happening. And so this is like you try to pour water over the transdimensional objects in front of you, the water of language, and it just beads up and flows off like water off a duck's back. You cannot say what's there. And I've spent, I don't know, 25 years fiddling with this. It's become the compass of my inspiration, trying to say what is on the other side of that boundary. Just two large tokes away at any given time is this non-Euclidean, non-Newtonian, irrational, un-Englishable place. But it's not smooth and empty and clear. That's not what gives it its indescribability. What gives it its indescribability is its utter weirdness, its alienness, its power to astonish. What happens to me when I smoke DMT is there's a kind of a going toward it. There's a sequela of events which lead to the antechamber of the mystery. I mean, you take a toke, you feel strange. Your whole body feels odd. You take a second toke, all the oxygen seems to have been pumped out of the room. Everything jumps into clarity. It's that visual acuity thing. You take a third toke, if you're able, and then you lay back and you see this thing which looks like a rose or a chrysanthemum, this orange spinning flower-like thing. It takes it about 15 seconds to form, and it's like a membrane. And then you break through it. You break through it, and then you're in this place. And there's an enormous cheer which goes up as you pass through this membrane. Some of you may know the Pink Floyd song about how the gnomes have learned a new way to say hooray. They're waiting. And you burst in to this place and you're saying, you know, geez, you know, this stuff is really speedy. I mean, that's like describing a space shuttle launching as noisy, you know. You say, this stuff is, it's, you know, and you say, am I all right? Am I all right? That's the first question. And so then you run your mind around the track and you say, heartbeat, normal, yeah, normal. Heartbeat, normal. Pulse, normal. Breathing, breathe, 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 yes. But what's right here, and from here out is this thing, which no matter how much science fiction you've done, no matter how much William Burroughs you've read, no matter how much time you've spent in the company of the weird, the bizarre, the ultra, and the peculiar, you weren't ready. And it's completely real. It's in a way more real than the contents of ordinary reality, because see how the shadows here are muted and there's a lot of transitional zones from one color to another and so forth. This isn't like that. This is crystalline, clear, solid. You can see the light reflected in the depths of these objects, and everything is very brightly colored, and everything is moving very, very rapidly. And there are entities there. It's not about calling them up or the whisperings of them. No, they're in your face. And they're right here, and they're worse than in your face, because what they do is they jump into your chest and then they jump out. And so you're like this. And you have to keep saying, keep breathing, don't freak out, pay attention, and the entities.
And the entities. Well, that was Terence McKenna, bless his heart, his chart, all coming alive with transits now, and we are doing Death by Astonishment, DMT, Terence McKenna radio, and we are also honoring the living Dr. Rick Strassman, author of DMT, the spirit molecule that has sold. So, hello, Rick. So your book, actually, DMT, the spirit molecule, has sold 150,000 copies, is that right?
Last I heard, 150. Six or something.
Wow!
Yeah.
So there's a huge hunger for this, but I want to toss it to you, and we can respond to what Terence had to say and bring him back in a little bit later. But after my own DMT experience, I was even more astounded that you had gotten government approval and funding for your research. I guess that you begin in 1990, 5 years to give 500 doses to 60 humans. That's amazing. but it is amazing. And you yourself have journeyed many times, have you?
Well, you know, Terence was quite instrumental in, you know, the design of my DMT study, actually. You know, I began looking at the biology of spiritual experience through my melatonin and pineal gland research in the mid, you know, 1980s. And it just wasn't psychedelic, even though there were some preliminary human data suggesting that, you know, melatonin was, you know, psychedelic. You know, but we gave a lot, and we studied it very carefully, and as everybody knows by now, melatonin is primarily sedating. In the meantime, though, I had learned about DMT, and I had met Terence, and I had just spent a, you know, week up on Cortez Island at a retreat center called Hollyhock Farm.
Yeah, me too. Okay.
Yeah, it's a great place. And I, you know, was able to, you know, reconnect with old friends, Rupert Sheldrake and Ralph, and, you know, Ralph Abraham. Right. And I was kind of, you know, talking about the dead end, you know, that the melatonin work had taken. And, you know, they kind of commiserated, and they said, well, how about DMT? You know, that's really a lot more interesting than melatonin. So I started thinking about it. And I stopped over at, you know, Terence's house on the drive home, spent a couple of, you know, days there. And we spent one entire day up in his loft. I don't know if you ever was at his place in Sebastopol in his, you know, library loft. But we spent a day in a smoke-filled room, so to speak, and we decided that the thing to do was to get the war on drugs to let me give DMT in the exact same, you know, way that we would like to see it given, which was the experienced trippers who would be able to really describe the territory with great, you know, detail. And instead of calling it a interesting, fascinating, amazing drug, we would approach it from the point of view of it being an abused drug. You know, so, so armed with that kind of, you know, conceptual framework or armamentarium, I returned to New Mexico, you know, dropped the melatonin work and started working on a grant proposal to let me get DMT to people.
And you were, what, kind of doing a double Terrence trick of pitching to the government as though this is a terrible problem and we must explore its abuse? Is that how you pitched it?
Well, you know, it wasn't quite, you know, that florid, but, you know, in, you know, general, that was the idea, is that, you know, DMT was the prototypical psychedelic tryptamine. And, you know, people were using mushrooms, people were taking acid. You know, DMT is still kind of an obscure drug. It, you know, it's not as obscure as it was, you know, 30 years ago, but, you know, relatively speaking, it's obscure now, and it was especially obscure back then. You know, so I could, you know, say it's an unknown drug. It's not going to become a, you know, public health, you know, problem, but it could provide insights into other psychedelics, which, you know, might cause, you know, public health problems, you know, could have a role in schizophrenia. You know, that was kind of the approach of psychiatry, looking at naturally occurring DMT.
Right.
When it was first discovered in the human body. You know, so it was this same study, you know, give DMT to people, but instead of it's an amazing, fascinating drug, I spun it in, you know, such a way that there were drug abuse implications and psychosis implications.
Right, but I want to go back to Terrence's great quote, which I found fabulously resonant after my own experience. He says, "Is it dangerous? Is it dangerous? Only if you fear death by astonishment." And then people laugh in the audience, as we just heard. And he goes, "A moment will come that will wipe the smile right off your face." And I go, I resonate with that too, because I some months-ish back, I did an experience, and I was like, oh, I love this. I love this. This is amazing to know that this substructure of reality, this, as Terrence says, crystalline, brightly colored, moving, you know, kind of the geometry of life, you know, and so I came back going, yes, sign me up for another, and let's increase the dose, you know, and I was like, whoa, and that's why I was also, I want to come back to you on dosages, because I was reading and listening to your CDs going, that's pretty high, because in the increased dose, I was like, whoa, you know, how like when you get into the ocean and you go, maybe this is bigger than I can, whoa, I know, and I do want to explore with you, because there was, I did not know about this. Terrence says there's no preparing, right? But you go way out, and I really, you know, Terrence says, you know, people might believe they were dead. I wondered if I was dead. And then what he says is that the world is replaced, all gone, because then there's some anxiety, like, maybe this is it. Maybe I have to say goodbye to everything. And then that person's gone. Like, and it's like, whoa! So it's huge. They might believe they were dead. So these people that you were working with, they were experienced journeyers and all, but it does take on to the mystery, and that's why I said if death is less showbiz, because it was very amazing, you know, death should get its money back. So you're also exploring the edge. It's a speculation that maybe when people die, there is an endogenous release of DMT. Maybe that is the experience of like, whoa, the whole big thing. I like saying entheogenic endogenous enthusiasm, because endogenous, it is within us all. And as you say, it's in our lungs. We manufacture DMT with our lungs. And also that you said that it exists in every mammal investigated and hundreds of plants.
Right. Well, it's been, you know, known to exist in the human lung a few years after it was discovered in the rabbit lung. And you know, that was almost, you know, 60 years ago now, those data came out. And in my DMT, you know, book, The Spirit Molecule, I speculate about the pineal gland being a potential source of DMT.
Right.
And, you know, 20 years later, a, you know, paper came out from Ann Arbor, which, you know, demonstrated DMT in the pineal gland of living rodents. You know, so it's expectable if anybody would perform a comparable experiment in, you know, living humans, that, you know, DMT would be discovered there. You know, but in the meantime, you know, the lungs are, you know, constantly producing it. You know, it's interesting, you know, the two, you know, well, the two points that you make about, you know, preparing for a big DMT experience and it's, you know, possible, you know, relationship to death and being afraid that you've died. In our, well, in my preparing the volunteers, you know, for their big DMT experience, you know, to the extent that you could prepare somebody, you know, there were two things that I told them. You know, one was to get as grounded as they could on the bed, you know, before I gave them the drug, you know, to relax, to breathe, to meditate, to, you know, feel the bed under their bodies, you know, to be as, you know, focused and concentrated, but at, you know, the same time relaxed as possible. And I also told, you know, people, you know, that they may fear that they've died. And, you've got, and you have a couple of options, and you fight against it, or you could say, okay, I've died, very interesting, what's next? You know, so I think those two bits of advice were, you know, the bare minimum that it was only, you know, fair to prepare people with, you know, to relax and to don't, you know, fight against the feeling of having died, because, you know, nobody's ever died from DMT.
Right. Well, that's important. A friend told me that beforehand, and there was some little part of me going, nobody's ever died. Okay. It was, so part of my interest in again spiraling this forth to those who know about this and those who don't is, you know, I think part of your work really, which is what qualities shall we all cultivate now as humans to be better participants and you know, on our planet, and also for the field of now. And you know, as you know, and as you've been guiding people, it is about releasing resistance. It just going, all right, here we go. Whoa, right, here we go. Because otherwise, no, you just want to, you know, again, hold nothing back. And here we go. There we go. So, yeah, am I all right? So I think it is important to tell people, as somebody did, it's small but large significance, going, no, your body is completely safe. Going, whew. Whew. So I think it's completely interesting, and I want to toss back to you also that you say in one of the interviews online, it exists in every mammal investigated and hundreds of plants as a kind of cross species Esperanto, kind of kinship. I do know from other journeying with psychoactive plants and psilocybe mushrooms and what that animals really like us when we're in that state. They're like, oh, now you're in our world. There we go. We can, the realms of intimacy do indeed seem opened up. Is that in sync with your experience?
Well, you know, in my study, we didn't include any pets, you know, or any animals. You know, there were the occasional insects that would maybe fly into their room.
Wow. What would they do?
Well, you know, there were flies generally, so we just kind of shooed them out of the room. But
okay.
Yeah, but there weren't any cats or dogs or mice or rats or birds or fish.
No. It's a government-sponsored lab,
right.
and you're a mystic disguised in a lab coat as a scientist. It's a good cover.
Right.
But no, I understand that. But just to sort of step to one side in the whole realm of journeying, the psilocybes, the entheogens, many of which again are endogenous. They are intrinsic to us, but I'm just putting out there that animals like it. I'm sure they were not in your double locked government funded research room.
It's you know, common knowledge, or you know, relatively common knowledge, that you know, people get along with, you know, with animals. Oh, it's interesting story. You know, Andy Weil tells this great story about his experience with a bumblebee. You know, like once upon a time he was extremely allergic, you know, to bee stings. And then one day, you know, he's tripping on acid and he's, you know, kind of, you know, looking at a bee that, you know, is in his space. And he feels great affection for it, a lot of closeness, and it stings him. And he has no reaction at all. And he's never responded to a bee sting with an allergic reaction since then.
Right. Yeah, no, we have a lot. We have a lot. I've known Andy since I was 16, and Rupert and Terrence. I spent 2 weeks in the rainforest, and yes, and Hollyhock. So there's all of that kin. Yeah, no, Andy was always interested in experimenting with that, mosquitoes stinging, and could we come into a state of equilibrium where we did not respond with an inflammation, but Jessica was like, sure, take the blood, no problem. There we go. Okay, so yeah, so we like that realm. And we're going to take a very short break in a moment and come back. But I know also your explorations in the whole realm of prophecy, which I would love for you to connect to DMT. That is not my experience yet. But I turn to you. We turn to you as a wonderful guide. We're going to have a very short music from KPFA. A very short break, and we will be right back.
Shook the constellation that dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Chanty, chanty, come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Ah, get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. That Taj Mahal conjure from his album Conjure that we've been using for 20 years on the show just keeps seeming more and more pertinent and relevant. Thank you, Taj Mahal, so much. So our theme, in a way, our loose theme is death by astonishment, which is Terrence McKenna's wonderful phrase for part of the experience of DMT that we'll explore. We played a little clip of Terrence at the beginning of the hour. We'll play a little bit more later, and our ancestral ally Terrence, whose messages are all hopping up and down for us now, and we are also hosting the living Dr. Rick Strassman, author of DMT, The Spirit Molecule, and his website is rickstrassman.com. So yeah, you know, in the clip we heard from Terrence, you know, he said the world is replaced on the DMT experience, all gone. It's the unspeakable, you know, the water of language, and so he was trying to speak of the unspeakable, and so were you, apparently typing up reports for the government with your government-funded DMT research, which is astounding. So, were you giving voice to the unspeakable?
Well, you know, there's unspeakable, and you know, there's unspeakable, you know, there's relatively unspeakable, and there's absolutely unspeakable.
Right.
I think, you know, one of our, you know, tasks as humans is to try to give words to approximate as closely as you can things which are ultimately unspeakable. But, I mean, you can stay, you know, silent, you can grunt, you could say, oh, wow, or you could really try to wrap words around that experience, because we communicate mostly verbally. You know, we could communicate visually and musically, but for, you know, most of the, you know, depth communication, what could be, you know, shared, transmitted, preserved, is verbal. So I think there is some, you know, merit. You know, Terrence obviously spent a lot of time in an attempt to articulate the DMT effect, and I think it's a worthy, you know, project. You know, more we can say about it, the closer we can approximate it.
Yeah, and just for the fun of it, you know, Terrence and I and many people, maybe 20, did spend 2 weeks in the rainforest of Mexico in all kinds of ways. But in the language of astrology, which he appreciated, but both he and I were born with the moon at 4 Virgo, same degree out of 360. The image for that is an Irishman dreams of little people. So he barked with laughter at that. And I told him about a friend of mine, Dr. Wu, who was exploring diseases of of light and darkness, and he himself had epilepsy. But he began to experience these 6 foot or taller praying mantis beings that would visit him, he said. And I mentioned that to Terrence, and Terrence said, "Oh yeah, old Shovelhead. Yeah, he's somebody that I often encounter." And I go, "So I want to toss it back to you, Dr. Rick Stressman." Because Terrence speaks of, and you are intrigued and exploring, that there are beings. Terrence said, that he said you experience beings that say we love you, and you come so rarely, and we have this urgency to communicate with you. And I did not go that far, or I went past that, I can't tell. Let's see, there's so many things I want to ask you, but you are intrigued that there are beings. Is that right?
Well, there are clearly beings. You know, you could see them sometimes. At least, you know, half of our volunteers, you know, saw beings with all kinds of, you know, shapes and forms. They could be insect-like bees, spiders, they could be mammals, they could be plants, trees, cactus-like creatures, machines or androids, you know, hybrids, even intelligent furniture, intelligent buildings. The, you know, common, you know, features were an intelligence, a, you know, sentience. The creatures or the beings were conscious of the volunteers', you know, presence and interacted with them. Also, they were generally extremely powerful. You know, they could exert an effect, either, you know, verbally or, you know, physically or emotionally, on the consciousness of the volunteer. And, you know, there was interaction. You know, there wasn't the white light, you know, merging with things that, you know, Terrence points out isn't the hallmark of the DMT effect. You know, the effect is extremely fulsome. It's busy, it's full, it's, you know, happening. You know, you were speaking early on about the importance of, you know, letting go, but I think that's only important in the early stages, you know, to be able to work through the anxiety of the rapidity of the transition.
Or any minor concern about being dead.
Or minor concern about being dead, you know, like, are you breathing? You know, but actually, you know, Terrence was, you know, talking about heart rate fine, breathing fine.
Right.
But I think if you get a full DMT experience, you're completely unaware of your body.
Yes.
Which is one of the reasons that you think you're dead, because you can't feel your heartbeat. You don't know if you're breathing or not. You can't, you know, and you're unaware of the room or, you know, whatever you're laying on. You know, so there is a completely, you know, disembodied state, which can require, you know, some adjusting, which is the importance of, you know, letting go and being.
Well, let me ask you about dosage, because as Terrence is speaking of the beings, and as you're speaking of the beings, part of me is going, "Gee, all I got was death," but a spectacular out there thing. Is that something? Do you think is that something that you then increase dosage with your experimental subjects, government funded, as you did in the 90s? Because I was astounded reading your dosage, because I don't know what was an average dose that you were giving to your government approved subjects.
Yeah, well, so we gave small doses, medium doses, and big doses.
And what would they, like, what's the number?
Yeah, well, we gave the fumarate salt of DMT as an injection rather than smoking the freebase, which is what most people do in the field. Well, our, you know, high dose was, you know, 0.4 milligrams per kilogram. Our threshold, you know, dose were, you know, people, you know, routinely broke through into the DMT space was 0.2 milligrams per kilogram. And smaller doses, you know, than that were, you know, mildly, you know, psychoactive, more or less. You know, but they weren't the, you know, distinguishable characteristic DMT space.
What is the number, you know, 50 or 60 mean to you?
Well, that would be, you know, milligrams of the freebase, you know, that you would vaporize and inhale from
right.
a pipe. Yeah.
And that would be a sort of low dose in your mind?
Well, you know, when you're smoking it, there's all the technical issues you've got to contend with. You know, you have to inhale as much as you can, as fast as you can. The room breaks up and you can't tell if you're inhaling or exhaling. You know, you can't, you know, feel your mouth, those kinds of things, which occur after the first hit or the second hit. And it's important to, you know, continue with a, you know, third one if you can. Well, you know what Terrence used to do is after you would lay down, you know, he would, you know, tell you in, you know, preparation, he would say, okay, if you can, in 5 minutes, I'm going to say, do you want some more? And if you could get up after that, you know, 5 minute point, you know, then he would give you like another hit and you would re-enter at even a higher level. At that point, you know, you'd lay back down and so, it would go on for another 10 minutes or so.
So I don't know if this is a relevant question, but is it like, well, okay, maybe I'm dead. Okay. Is it after that that you encounter beings or is that a relevant question at all?
Well, so the beings occur, you know, once you've become, you know, disembodied, so to speak. You know, the first, you know, half a minute or the first, you know, minute is, you know, the transition into that, you know, disembodied state. And, you know, so once you're there, you know, there's no body, there's no breathing, there's no, you know, heart rate, and you start looking around and, or they start making themselves known to you visually or somatically or, you know, mentally, you know, telepathically. Well, so they would appear maybe at the 90-second point, you know, the 2-minute point, and, you know, then you'd interact with them to the extent, you know, that they were there and you weren't interacting with them for maybe 2-3 minutes or so, and they start to fade at that point.
So what is your enthusiasm, or maybe it's a reciprocal enthusiasm with DMT, for humans now? Is it something useful for our increasing conscious kinship? I mean, because Terrence spoke about, you know, the being saying, you come here so rarely and it's so fleeting, and he said there was an urgency, you know, an urgency. Is that something, is that one way you narrate to yourself?
Well, you know, it's interesting. That is a, you know, common description or a, you know, common, you know, report that the volunteers would return with, you know, that the beings were pleased that we had made contact with them. You know, time was limited and they really felt, you know, hurried to try to get as much across as they could. You know, communication was difficult. Either people didn't understand, you know, the language, or the beings weren't able to understand the volunteers. You know, the anxiety of the volunteer to have encountered a being of trying to communicate with them would make it hard to establish reciprocal communication.
And you're meanwhile kind of writing this up in science academic language for government readers somewhere?
Well, you know, when people would come down, I would start, you know, speaking with them. You know, we would start having a, you know, conversation at about the 20-minute point. And I would say, you know, what happened? And, you know, they would tell me, and I'd ask questions, and, you know, I took, you know, copious notes, which I had learned as a medical student, was to just, you know, kind of, you know, transmit, you know, auditory input into my ear, you know, through my fountain pen on my notepad. You know, so I was able to, you know, write down pretty much everything that, you know, people would, you know, talk about after they came down. You know, so we'd spend maybe half hour after a large dose of DMT, you know, talking about, you know, what they had undergone.
But was there some bureaucrat in some dusty office reading these reports going, hoof?
Well, actually, you know, no.
Okay.
The things, you know, that the bureaucrats were, you know, looking at were, the number of, you know, volunteers that got what amount of drug, any bad effects, what kind of data we were generating, you know, biological, you know, neuroendocrine, you know, cardiovascular data. You know, the notes that I, you know, kept, I didn't actually, you know, share, you know, to that, you know, large an extent until I completed, you know, my work. You know, in the first couple of articles which we published in the scientific literature, I, you know, summarized a certain, you know, number of characteristics of the higher doses, but like a paragraph here and a paragraph there.
So and it occurred to me also since the experience, it's kind of like the vocabulary of life, the geometric crystalline vocabulary of creation. And then there's the participatory dynamic and the eagerness to explore more. And then as I look at, the kind of toxic mimic of modern life and, commercials and bombardment, I go, well, it's kind of like a toxic mimic, whatever, of the DMT experience that, like so much of culture, it's kind of derived from psychedelic experience, but not in any meaningful way. It's kind of tapping into some part of us that responds to that, and then it's, I don't know, I mean, have you ever noticed the advertising color and rhythm of what's bombarding us and thought of that as a toxic mimic of DMT?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think even more in, some ways an ominous, trend is this whole, what's it called? I'm even blocking on the concept. Oh, virtual reality.
Yeah.
You've put on these, microphones, these headphones and these, these eye, sets, these goggles, and you're immersed in a DMT-like world, maybe low-dose DMT or medium-dose DMT, and it's, at some point they'll be able to, replicate or, I wouldn't say replicate, more like mimic, the expression that you used, the DMT experience. But the, kind of malignant, part of that is it's created by humans.
Right.
It isn't, kind of from the top down. It's more of a, bottom up kind of phenomenon.
No, it's the con man and the trickster. I mean, it's the con that imprisons rather than the trick that liberates. We're gonna go back to just a couple of minutes of Terrence just to and fro. But allies are also interested. So let me ask you this, sort of again too. So the DMT receptor sites, like we have cannabinoid sites, they are in our bodies. You said the lungs manufacture it, but where are, is it in our brain? Where are the DMT receptor sites?
Well, so they occur in the brain primarily.
Okay.
But, they also occur on the blood vessels, in the muscles, on endocrine organs. Like the adrenals.
It is a very intriguing thought, I think, that occurs to those who journey in this way, which is this what happens at death? Does the body release this DMT or something? Is that the experience of, because I've spoken to people, so there's the, go gently into white light narrative, which I love Terrence kind of, poo-pooing, giving the Bronx cheer to. And then some people have said, that it was a kind of exploding into molecular ecstasy, and then they did come back, but that was their almost dying moment. And we go, well, I don't know about the ecstasy part, but exploding into molecular something, but is that something that you continue to ponder, if that is in fact part of the death exit experience that people might have, no matter how suddenly they're taken from their life?
Well, that's a huge...
It is huge.
...number of topics.
But
back in the day when I first started to think about, DMT and the near-death state, I learned that DMT increases in the brain in stressed animals.
So if
there's any stress which occurs to an organism, it's as it's dying. So there's adrenaline, noradrenaline, all those stress hormones released, and there seems to be a concomitant increase in DMT in rodent brain anyway. It's not been studied in humans. But there is a couple of studies that actually, came out in schizophrenics in the late, 1960s, early 1970s, looking at levels of DMT in the urine of psychotic individuals, and it seemed to increase if patient was increasingly symptomatic, and that usually was a result of some kind of stress. So there's some circumstantial evidence within humans, and more direct evidence in lower animals that DMT increases in stress. you know, the same group in Michigan that discovered DMT in the pineal is also looking for DMT in the dying rodent brain, and they're working on that right now. Well, there's a, you know, group in Hungary that has been, you know, looking at the possibility that, you know, DMT is neuroprotective at the time of death, and it's released or, you know, possibly released as a, you know, defensive, you know, kind of mechanism, you know, to prevent, you know, brain damage when your heart has stopped beating or you've had a stroke. So it, you know, could be that, you know, DMT has got a number of, you know, functions as you're dying. It can help, you know, protect the brain, but at the same time, it, you know, might be the way in which consciousness begins to leave the body. And experience those kind of intermediary, you know, visual, you know, emotional, all kinds of other, you know, perceptual effects as one dies.
So I just want to raise my hand in the corner of the classroom going, oh, I hate that they killed the rats. I do. I go, can't we learn from life? Can't we follow Dr. Rick Strassman and give it to living humans? Anyway, I know we can't study death in humans, but and then just the psychic psychotic so close together, you know, is it a diagnosis or a narrative context? I mean, if one were to be, you know, gripped by a naturally released or not DMT experience and didn't know, you would think you might grab a label like schizophrenic. You know, and I know with a number of people close to me who've had complete psychotic breaks, is the doctors had said, whatever you do, don't talk about mythology with them because it just sets them off, you know. But it was the only thing that guided. And in fact, in a couple of people, they said I was in a bubble in there, moving in their bloodstream, telling them that it was okay and just to let go and it was going to be fine in the midst of all the thing, you know. But so there's that wondering about psychic psychotic. But but I want to go back to Terrence for just a few, like 2.5 minutes, and then come back in with our to and fro. So here's just a little bit more of Terrence.
Form our language somehow. And I don't know what this means. I mean, at this point in the weekend and in my life, we all are on the cutting edge, and nobody is ahead of anybody else. Clearly we need to transform our language, because our culture is created by our language, and our culture is toxic, murderous, and on a downhill bummer. Somehow we need to transform our language. But is this what they mean? That we're supposed to condense machines out of the air in front of us? How does this relate to the persistent idea promulgated by Robert Graves and other people that there is a primal language of poetry? That poetry as we know it is a pale, pale thing, and that at some time in the human past, people were in command of languages which literally compel belief. They compel belief because they don't make an appeal through argument or metaphor. They compel belief because they are able to present themselves as imagery. You know, William Blake said, if the truth can be told so as to be understood, it will be believed. And so these things have... And it's very confusing, because you wonder, you say, well, have people been doing this for thousands of years? And if so, have they always encountered this tremendous urgency on the other side? If people have been doing it for thousands of years, why is there this urgency on the part of these entities? And who exactly and what exactly are they? It appalls me, you can probably tell, that I have to talk about this, because I am not, this is not my bailiwick. I mean, I'm a rationalist who's just had a very weird set of experiences, but I am a rationalist. I mean, I have no patience with channeling, you know, the lords of the many rays, the divas, and, you know, there's this whole thing going around about disincarnate intelligence, and it's mostly in the, under the control of fairly, shall we say, non-rigorous thinkers. But I like to think that I am a rigorous thinker, and yet here I am telling you that, you know, elf legions await in hyperspace one toke away. The difference between...
So I do love the spicy part of Terrence McKenna's standards going, I have no patience with channeling, or how shall we say, fairly non-rigorous thinkers. And we go, oh, we could use a little spice. That's really good. But to his question, Dr. Rick Strassman, our living mystic in a lab coat, you know, have people been doing this for thousands of years?
Well, people have been using ayahuasca for thousands of years, most likely. You know, there's some evidence from South America that it's been used for, you know, for maybe even 5,000 years. So, but, you know, speaking of ayahuasca and, you know, the urgency that Terrence talks about and that my DMT volunteers talked about, I think, you know, it's a function of time. I think you're blasted into the DMT space when you smoke or inject it, and you just don't have that much, you know, time in that world. You know, if you talk to people that, you know, do ayahuasca regularly and are comfortable in that space, there's plenty of contact with beings in the ayahuasca world, and it isn't as hurried or as frantic anywhere, you know, nearly as much as the case with inhaled or injected DMT.
And, well, and this is, again, we're opening up conversations that could be entire books and shows, but that is the interesting dynamic about, you know, synthetic versus plant, and something that Andy Wiley, you know, used to talk about a lot too, which, I mean, because he was saying there's no drug-free cultures, but there are cultures with no problems, and when you take things into a little white powder, you're removing it from its alkaloid context and running into problems, as opposed to whole plant. But there's a lot of, you were working with a pharmacological synthetic, yes?
Yeah, it was made in a lab at Purdue University. Dave Nichols made it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but still, you know, DMT is DMT.
Okay.
You could extract DMT from plants and make it as pure as the drug that we gave to the volunteers. But, you know, if you were interested in a prolonged pure DMT state, you know, one of the, you know, things about ayahuasca is it contains the beta carbolines, which allow the DMT to be orally active. But, you know, the beta carbolines have got effects of, you know, Well, so they have, you know, got their own effects. You know, so you're not, strictly speaking, completely in a purely DMT state. It's a combination of DMT and, you know, the beta carbolines. But, a colleague, in Britain, is, you know, working on a, you know, model for a continuous infusion of DMT.
Uh-huh.
You know, like over the space of hours.
All right, sign me up.
And you'd be able to enter into it gradually and, you know, hover for as long as you want on plane one. And then, you know, level two, you could say, okay, I'm ready for level two.
Well, we're going to have to deconvene right now in our convening. But let's stir these things. I'd love to keep this conversation going because it's completely intriguing. Thank you so much, Dr. Rick Strassman, rickstrassman.com. Thanks always to Yasha Frazier in Washington, D.C., and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey, coyotenetworknews.com. Follow me on Twitter at StandUpCoyote. Thank you very much, Rick. I want to stir and bubble these things and speak with you backstage and onstage again. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Caroline.
Woof, woof.
Tired of The Matrix?
The movie?
No, not the movie, but the one you're living in. If so, then hang out with your friends at The Full Circle.
What's The Full Circle?
Full Circle's a radio show written, produced, and directed by apprentices right here at KPFA. We'll bring you everything from the obscure to the obvious, the hidden and the blatant, as well as all things in between. So be informed. Hear about your world community every Friday night from 7 to 8 p.m. on 94.1 FM, where we'll serve you the red pill with love.
Jeremy Scahill is the war correspondent who wrote Blackwater and Dirty Wars, produced the film Dirty Wars, and is one of the three founding editors of the online investigative magazine The Intercept. Jeremy and Intercept staff have just published The Assassination Complex, a book of revelations about the U.S. government's hell-driven drone program and secret assassination policy. Jeremy will speak on Monday evening, May 9th at 7:30 p.m. at the First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way in Berkeley. This KPFA benefit is wheelchair accessible. Tickets available at brownpapertickets.com and cherished indie bookshops. Don't hesitate. May 9th, Jeremy Scahill. He's important.
And you're listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF.